Today is the third day of our July-August 7-day session. It's the 1st of August 2017. And we continue today in a series of talks going back to basics and looking at some of the pitfalls that come with the different practices and possible countermeasures. And today we're going to look at koans. Just for new people, this word koan comes from a Chinese word gongan, which means public case or precedent. This comes from Chinese law, so it's like an example of the workings of the law. But in this case, we're talking about the Buddha Dharma, of course. And most of the koans are an account of a particular incident between two masters or more, or between master and student. And they mostly take place in China, with some added stories coming from the sutras, which usually said in India, sometimes in heavenly realms. And these stories, or mondo, as they're called in Japanese, are very often paradoxical, even nonsensical to our usual ways of thinking, but at the same time full of meaning and containing very specific teachings. They address some aspect of the Dharma and express it in a dramatic form. So the beauty of the koans is that they bring these teachings down to earth and express them through relationship, through interchanges usually between people. And so this makes them much more concrete for us. And we have to approach them in this manner of concreteness. In fact, get them into our bodies. So the student's job in taking up a koan is to look into the meaning. And with our first primary koan, you usually don't work on the whole story. You know what the story is, and you may examine it, the case, but when you actually work with the koan, you take up a word or phrase from the case, and this is what is worked on in our zazen and off the mat as well. And this word or phrase is the nub. It's like the crux of the whole exchange, the whole story. For instance, with the koan mu, that the case is a monk asked Joshu in all seriousness, does a dog have a Buddha nature or not? And Joshu said, mu. So the whole case is that story, and the nub is the word mu, or wu in Chinese. And this is referred to as the huado. It's an interesting word, huado, because it means the head of something, like the head of a snake as opposed to the tail. And everybody knows if you're having to deal with a snake, you better grab it behind the head rather than by the tail, or it could bite you. So the head is, again, it's the center, the essential bit. The crux. And it's a word. Sometimes in Japanese I'll refer to muji, which means the koan mu, the word mu, rather. But the great Chinese master Shuyun said that really the huado was pointing to what was prior to words. But from a practical point of view, the way it works is that it boils down the story to a very simple question that we can work with. A koan is a little bit like a kind of prism. Some of you may have done this as kids, where you take a prism and you put it into a strong shaft of sunlight, and then you get some paper. And if you put that paper in the right place on the other side of the prism, from the direction that the light is coming in, you can burn a hole in that paper, because the prism gathers all the light that's coming into it into a single beam. And that's what the potential of a koan is. All our questions of all kinds, all our the things we struggle with, philosophical type questions, existential questions, questions about our lives, nature of reality, good and evil, meaning, purpose, suffering, love, work, all of the things that we struggle to come to terms with, we can pour all of these into a single question. Mu. Or what? Or who? And this is really what gives a koan its great power. And if we do this, we can burn through our habitual ways of seeing and experiencing things. And then the truth is revealed. So koans are particularly useful if you have a lot of burning questions, if you have a lot of doubt. Though perhaps perplexity is a clearer way of talking about it, because I'm not talking here about skeptical doubt, but real questions, concerns that take the form of questioning. Let's read a little bit here again from Master Sheng Yen. This is in a book called Illuminating Silence. And it's subtitled The Practice of Chinese Zen. And it's edited and with introductions and commentaries by John Crook, who was a Dharma successor of Master Sheng Yen, an English layman, who unfortunately has passed away. And in this passage, Master Sheng Yen talks a little bit about the gongan, the koan, and the huado. He says, in Song Dynasty China, gongans and huados became important means of training large bodies of monks in monasteries. Some teachers referred to this practice as using poison to extract poison. I'm sure everyone can relate to that, who's working on a car, and that sometimes it feels like poison, bitter to the taste. Sometimes an insight into a Gongan or Huado may trigger an enlightenment experience, and the method is therefore considered to be a key to enlightenment. There are many Gongans that have been compiled into collections with a commentary. When teachers present a practitioner with a Huado, there is usually no talk of levels of use. The Huado is to be approached directly, immediately, and should yield an instantaneous response. Yet many people, especially lay practitioners in the West, find this merely confusing. If a master says, "Go and investigate the Huado," the practitioner may well go off and try to do so, but actually she may have no idea what to do and waste a lot of time. I would therefore like to present this practice in terms of four levels of use. In the first level, he names repeating the Huado. This is what he says. A master gives a student a Huado to practice on, but normally it remains pretty meaningless to the student. He cannot question it, so he just repeats it, much as he would if he were reciting a mantra. Such a practice is useful because it at least calms the mind and brings it from a scattered to a more focused state. So people sometimes say, I can't generate the questioning. And it's important just to understand that sometimes we can't. But you're not entirely wasting your time if you just very faithfully and steadily repeat the koan. Of course, doing our best to generate that questioning is useful, but we don't have to feel like we're just completely treading water when that the question isn't there. The important thing always is to keep the koan alive. It's like in ancient times, ancient people would have to, if they were moving from one place to another, they would carry an ember with them in order to start the fire in the next place that they stopped. And of course this took a lot of intention and focus. And it's interesting that the word focus is related to the word for fireplace in many languages. So we can think of working on the koan as being like carrying an ember that we have to breathe on to keep it alive, to keep it burning. And with an ember, you have to get how much you breathe on it right. If you breathe too hard, you can put it out. So it takes some sensitivity to discern how to do that, how to keep that ember going. Furthermore, such simple repetition may induce strange or wondrous experiences. This, again, is like a person who evokes a powerful response through mantra practice, but one that must not be confused with enlightenment. And he's talking here about powerful makyo, which we can have as we concentrate our mind. And they can strengthen our faith, in fact, in that they give us a sense of what is possible, that give us a sense of the power of the mind. But we just must not get waylaid there, but keep pressing on. The second stage, he mentions, is questioning the Huado. He says, when you repeat a Huado, a question may appear in your mind. It may occur to you to ask, who is repeating the Huado? Such a question amounts to a Huado in its own right. Once such a question comes into clear focus, you should stay with it, not switching from one to another. You are still repeating the Huado, but following it with an inquiring mind. So again, it is important not to switch back and forth between practices, but occasionally it can be helpful. But it's really, it's again, as we were talking about yesterday, it's the spirit in which it's done. So at the second stage, there's both the repeating and the engaging with the koan, with the inquiring mind. And one can be at this stage for a long, long time. And also we can move between the first and the second, back and forth, depending on how concentrated we are as well. So we don't necessarily just get to that point of questioning and then stay with it constantly, but rather we may get, when we're starting out, flashes of doubt or perplexity in relation to the koan, and then sort of just being able to repeat it, and then another flash, and then maybe extending those periods when that sense of questioning is there to longer periods or periods of more intensity. So it's not a straight line. The third stage is great doubt. When a practitioner feels an urgent need to understand the Huado and to answer the question, the great doubt arises. There is now more or less an obsession with the question. You continue asking and asking with great earnestness and resolve. The mind is so filled with the question that eventually the whole universe appears as one gigantic question. This is then called the great mass of doubt. The universe itself is the Huado. This is the level to which the Chinese apply the term san, meaning investigate. You could say that at this stage, the koan investigates us as much as we investigate the koan. Become gripped by it. It all through these stages, there can be a real sense of unease. So one has to be in entering into koan work. One has to make the commitment to bear with that unease. A koan sets up a kind of imbalance. It's a question that demands an answer, and so it has this quality of incompleteness. So it sets us off balance. It's one of the brilliant ways in which it works. Just as it constellates self and other, we come up, when we work on a koan, we come up against all the ways we relate to the other, all the dysfunctional ways, the very things that bring us to practice, that we want to get away from, we have to face. So the master said, the poison that expels poison. The fourth stage here that Master Xing Yin mentions is watching the Huado. And he says, actually, this level can be said to apply only to those who have already seen the nature, in other words, experienced Kensho, which is what Kensho translated into English is, to see the nature. When a person has had an enlightenment experience, this does not mean she or he is completely and permanently enlightened. Even for those with some experience of Kensho, there remains the necessity for further cultivation, deepening one's practice. Watching the Huado ensures that the power of the practice does not fade. The Huado is simply called to mind and allowed to evoke what it will. It may be that experiences get deeper and deeper, or it may be that they are just like bubbles that arise and disperse in a running brook. For some people, the basic Huado may become their fundamental practice for the rest of their lives. This is the case often in Korea, where what is this is assigned and then worked on for the rest of one's life. And it's a particularly suitable practice for this, because it's a practice which engages with whatever is in front of us, and we just look. What? But mu could be exactly the same. And here we certainly don't just work on mu once. It can be very helpful to come back again and again to our primary koan. Koans are inexhaustible. They're unfathomable. He continues, perhaps you are wondering about those who have reached ultimate enlightenment. Do they still need to practice? Unless they have reached perfect Buddhahood, practice will remain important even for them. It is like homework that you do even though you do not need to do it. Once upon a time, there was an enlightened master who continued to prostrate regularly to the Buddha statue. When people asked him why he did this, he simply said that it was what he did. I think it's probably referring to Master Huangbo, who was said to have a big bump on his forehead, a carbuncle, from doing so many prostrations. Another master continued to read sutras. When he was asked why he bothered to do so, it probably means here, I would think, recite sutras. When he was asked why he bothered to do so, he said he did it to shield his eyes. Even great masters continue their practice. When you are practicing at the second level, many questions may arise. Perhaps they come from the books you've been reading, or they are a guess you make. Maybe a question comes up from your unconscious. No matter how it arises, whenever an answer takes the form of words or an idea, it is most assuredly wrong. Maybe you are delighted by your answer. That's it, you may exclaim to yourself. But be careful. Very soon you will be like a deflated balloon, or like someone who, under LSD, has written down an answer to the riddle of the universe and, on coming to, reads a load of rubbish. I bet there are other people in the room who've experienced that. I have a memory of going on an LSD trip with my boyfriend and a friend. And the friend didn't want to take it, but she really wanted to know what it was like. And so apparently, I don't remember this, but she kept on asking us, what's it like? What's going on? And we'd go, it's... And then there'd be a sort of dot, 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 and we wouldn't be able to say a thing. And she complained, she derided us afterwards because of this. But it's an important point, because if, however wonderful the experience might be, if it can't be communicated and it has no meaning beyond the experience itself, then what's the point? if you can have this marvelous spiritual vision, but if you don't have the soul that can hold that experience, then it's gone. It's meaningless. The Huado does not follow the logic of the reasoning mind. If you try to figure out an answer or seek a subtle phrase to contain some insight, you will be mistaken. Someone who comes up with such an answer is like someone awakening at night and mistaking a thief for his father. If you get into a bad habit of this kind, you will invite many thieves into your house. This is probably more an instruction for people who don't have access to regular access to a teacher, because that's the wonderful thing. If something does come up and you do think it's wonderful, you can come and test it out, and then you won't hold on to it. You just keep going, and that's the important thing. The danger if you think you have an answer when you don't is that you stop questioning. You don't go as far as you could go. So this brings us to the pitfall that we're going to look at today. The pitfall with koan work is trying to figure it out. We're going to do it because it's going to be very alluring to try it. And what is going on there is that we're really working from what we already know. And we'll do that again and again and again, because that's what we usually do when we try to solve a problem. But we need to exhaust that impulse. Probably you've heard Roshi say this about Mu. It's not what you think. So the key in working on koans is to abandon all our concepts, all our knowledge, all our previous experience. We have to abandon even our desire to see into the koan. This is the paradox of koan work, that can seem so directed, such a in a sense goal-oriented practice, and yet even the goal has to be put down until just the question remains. As Master Shingyan was saying before, until it fills the whole universe. So another passage in this book which really gets to the core of what this is about, and this is not Master Shingyan speaking, but the editor of this book, John Crook. It is important to emphasize yet again that any self-willed intention to become enlightened is doomed to failure. An ego-based activity simply precludes the movement in which self-concern is dropped. And self-concern is the core of our difficulties. Let's read that again, because it's so important to understand this. It is important to emphasize yet again that any self-willed intention to become enlightened is doomed to failure. An ego-based activity simply precludes the movement in which self-concern is dropped. Now you may hear this and think, but if I drop my desire for enlightenment, then I won't practice. We have this fear or concern because we think we're the ego. But actually this aspiration to wake up comes from a deeper place, a much, much, much deeper place. Mu yearns to be realized. That's what we rely on. The practice of the meditation method is naturally motivated towards success and is ultimately self-defeating unless it can go beyond intentionality. It's an interesting way of putting it. Naturally motivated towards success. If we have this deep aspiration, and really everybody does to one degree or another, it's just how buried it is, then there's an incredible momentum behind that if we can open up to it. But ultimately we have to go beyond intentionality. Here lies the paradox of the Zen koan. The paradox that to go beyond the discriminating mind, the mind that distinguishes the question, has itself to take leave. Since deliberation is not helpful, a form of giving up has to occur. Abandonment of method, wanting, and concern. This can only arise, as it were, accidentally. And most descriptions of Kensho suggest that a slight shock or sudden shift in attention can induce the change in a mind that is ready. This is very crucial to understand, that it happens when it happens, and really, as he says, in a sense, accidentally. But somebody once said about this that practice was, I don't remember exactly, but something like creating the right atmosphere for accidents to happen. Such a moment thus tends to rise arbitrarily when a person is crossing a yard, drinking a cup of tea, suddenly seeing a bird or falling rocks. One notable trigger for an awakening experience was somebody seeing urinating in the snow and seeing the bubbles as he urinated. So anything can do it. Although meditation work can deliberately induce the various forms of illumination in which the self is invisible due to a strong outward attention, it cannot induce the self to make itself absent. Enlightenment, whether as an experience or as knowing, is said to always arise suddenly, whereas training in meditation is gradual. It comes about in its own time. As Shifu says, let the universe do it. And we'll repeat this, that we can't induce the self to make itself absent, because in trying to do that, it's the self that's trying to induce the self to make itself absent. And I think we can put a lot of energy into, over many years, into trying to induce the self to go absent. Or we get to a point where we get more concentrated and we think to ourselves, I'm getting more concentrated. And then we just absolutely get so furious with ourselves for having a thought of self. And that can be a vicious cycle where we that pulls us out of our absorption, and it can be very, very painful. So the more we can remember that trying to induce the self to be absent is futile, then the more anguish we can save ourselves. Just keep turning back to the question. Simple, clean, straightforward. Again, it is never the case that the self as the reference point of individual cognition is ever destroyed. If it were, the person would not be capable of functioning in the world. What seems to happen is that self-reference simply goes absent, gets switched off, and thereby reveals its extraordinarily obsessive presence almost all the time. With self-reference switched off, the heart-mind takes off in new and revelatory states of being, bliss, voidness of thought, and love, which, as it were, rotate according to their own rules that appear universal rather than personal. Although meditation work cannot induce enlightenment, there is every reason to suppose that it facilitates the possibility of an enlightenment happening. The vital thing here is to explore the meaning of no intention. So again, sometimes people are afraid that if they lose themselves in their practice, that somehow the self that is describing here, the reference point of individual cognition, will also be wiped out. And of course, it isn't. And it doesn't have to be, because it's not the problem. To have a consciousness is to have a center of consciousness, which is how the ego is defined in some kinds of psychology. The problem is our attachment to that center of consciousness and our favoring of it over other centers of consciousness. As we have just seen, even an enlightenment experience does not mean the total and irrevocable elimination of the egoistic self or its fixations. A human being cannot function in the world without an operational ego. It is then not the self-function that finally disappears, but rather the attachment to personal identification. But rather the attachment to personal identifications that subsequently reemerge when the experience has passed away. Yet these can now begin to diminish with the shocking discovery of their illusory and inessential nature. So the strong attachment we have to what he calls the self function can start to dissolve a little when we've seen it, how illusory it is, how it's a fiction. And not just once, but over and over and over again. That's what the koans we undertake after a preliminary koan are about, as returning to mu in all its forms over and over again, and seeing through that self concept again and again and again. As self-concern is replaced by inner peace and contemplative compassion for sentient beings, so wisdom arises. As Shifu explained at a retreat in Berlin in 1999, the egoistic functions are taken over by wisdom. When such a condition is well established, others may consider such a person to be an enlightened being, although he or she would not be impressed by such an accolade. Compassion now being their prevalent concern and their natural basis, questions of attainment or rank no longer concern them. Such beings are rare treasures in the world. We should note that the psychological dynamics we have discussed do not reveal a transcendence of the human condition as such, but rather postulate a transcending of the self-absorption that lies at the heart of suffering. Experience and conceptuality work together to reveal this insight, based on the universal law of interdependent origination as the root of the emptiness of phenomena. So seeing into the insubstantiality of our notions of self. And how those very notions of self are completely and utterly dependent on what we think of as other. So how the question may arise in people's minds, how do we get beyond this self-concern, this self-partiality? It can seem to be an impossible task. It's a kind of catch-22. Where we get, if we don't make progress, we get caught in disappointment and frustration. But if we do, that gives rise to our self getting excited about it, and so we just feel caught up in the sense of self. We just feels a little bit like getting noses rubbed in it again and again and again. Where this all shifts is in that third stage that Master Xing Yi mentions of great doubt, when we become gripped by the question, when we're consumed by it and burned up by it. But as John Crook has pointed out, it can't be manufactured. It can't be produced on demand. Of course, we live in a culture where so much is available on demand. The click of a mouse. So we can really resist fully accepting this fact that we can't realize the koan on demand. So a huge part of practice is learning to just practice wherever we are at any given moment, and to do that practice with great patience. Another thing is just to not think that it's a shameful thing to have an ego. Remember, I felt this way when I first started out. I thought everyone else has not got an ego, but I've got this massive one that I have to deal with. In Buddhist teaching, there's this level of consciousness they call persistent eye awareness. And that was my major experience in my first sesshin, was 7 days of persistent eye awareness. Very stubborn. But we don't have to get rid of this ego, the center of our consciousness. But we do need to bring our question to it, apply the question to it. Somewhere in his teachings, Master Shen Yin actually suggests that when we first sit down on the mat at the beginning of a round, you actually connect with that sense of I, with the one who's experiencing you're sitting there. So to feel the body, and then to feel that sense of self there. And we may experience it in a certain way, a physical way, that we sense ourselves in space and on the mat. For me, when I first did this exercise, it seemed that my sense of self mainly centered around tightness in my throat. And then just to bring, having connected with the body in the present moment, then just to bring the questioning to that sense of self. And of course, remembering what we were talking about in other earlier talks, about the relaxing the upper body, the eyes, the facial muscles, the head, the neck, the shoulders, arms, the chest. Let that whole upper body rise up out of a very strong base, where there's some sense of weight and power, with the breath centered in the hara, the legs or the feet grounded, connected to the earth. We say relaxed, but really it's a taut kind of relaxation. Not just completely floppy, but poised, alert. And then having brought the koan to the sense of self, how we experience being alive in our body in this given moment, then just to apply the question right there, without relying on thinking, without trying to figure anything out, in an unhurried, steady way. In the Sufi tradition, they use this metaphor for the spiritual seeker as being a lover seeking out the beloved. So if you think of working on a koan is like a lover looking into the eyes of her beloved. And it being a committed relationship. In other words, having a willingness to work through the difficulties that arise, which will arise as they do in any committed relationship. Keeping in mind that the ultimate goal is stupendous, full enlightenment, Buddhahood, and just whatever it takes to get there. And it is a path, it's a journey. But there's a fundamental understanding that to enter onto that path is to have already arrived. Just finish up now with another short passage from Master Shen Yin and a little comment. He He says when you start to sit in meditation, you can directly enter the practice by energetically asking your question over and over. For example, in your mind you would ask, what is mu? What is mu? What is mu? And here's the most helpful piece of advice. You must direct the asking to the hua do, not to yourself. Continue at a moderate pace and always ask for the questioning mind. Let your mind settle into the method. Become friends with it. When there is nothing in your mind but finding the answer, this is called investigating the hua do. Well, we'll stop there and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow